I'm Ron Barr, and welcome to this special U.S. Airways in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA. Sports Byline is America's sports talk show and heard on more than 200 U.S. radio stations, Sirius XM satellite radio, as well as worldwide on the Internet and the more than 500 stations of the American Forces Radio Network. On this special in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA, we'll talk boxing with Sugar Ray Leonard. Leonard is a five-time champion, but his life wasn't all wins. Football with quarterback Craig Morton, who played 18 years in the NFL with three teams, and baseball with Vida Blue, who was so good that he once was traded for seven players. So sit back and enjoy this special in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA. First up, Sugar Ray Leonard. Anyone who saw Leonard box on the way to his five world titles in five weight classes was impressed with his quick hands and fancy footwork. He exploded on the scene when he won an Olympic boxing gold medal in Montreal. Pro boxing success quickly followed, and his boyish good looks and engaging personality made him a fan and media star. But his path to boxing greatness and his life outside the ring had a dark side. Now a successful boxing promoter, television personality, and Dancing with the Stars participant, Leonard has written a personally revealing book, The Big Fight, My Life in and Out of the Ring. In it, Leonard is brutally honest about the skeletons in his closet. I asked him, how painful was it to write this book?
Well, Ron, first of all, let me say that, I cherish our friendship, and although we see each other every, 20 years, I think, it seems like. But the book was a process. It was a very tedious and very emotional process. It took me nearly 2 years to get the confidence to really allow myself to be transparent. To drop my guards down, to put my hands down, and just be honest. And, it's one of those things that I'm proud of, yet there's a sense of embarrassment for my character defects and my behavior. But it's not a sad book at all. It's not about tragedy. It's obstacles that I've faced that I've, now I can honestly say that I've overcome. Come July 4th, it will be 5 years of sobriety for me. And that's, without question, one of my greatest championships, my belt.
Did you have to write this book in order to better understand yourself? I came away with that impression, and also to kind of free yourself of your past to be able to move forward.
This book was necessary to free myself. To understand myself. Let me be honest with you. I still don't understand myself sometimes. But it gave me, it allowed me to release those demons and those and that pressure and the guilt and all the other things that I've carried inside my heart for so long.
You were raised in the Washington, D.C. area. I was born in Washington, D.C., so I know what the area is like. But tell me what it was like for a black person to grow up in that city and in that vicinity.
Well, although I was very young, I experienced an incident that really rattled me when, I went into walking down to the monument from my house, my apartment, I should say, and I was thirsty, so I wanted to get a glass of water, and the guy outright called me the N-word, but not just casually, it was with hatred. I mean, I looked in his face and looked in his eyes that he meant what he said, to get out of here, get out of here. And that too, I didn't tell anyone except I think I told my mom, because I was expecting to hear my mom getting upset and telling me why, but she kind of pushed that under the rug, like most things are pushed under the rug.
I know it's been said, and it says it in the book, that in Washington, D.C., there were two ways in order to get yourself in the newspaper. One of them was to do crime.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the other one?
Well, the boxing. Boxing, and I chose boxing. But to be honest with you, Ron, I didn't realize what I had embarked upon. A career, something that allowed me to take care of my parents when they were very ill. But I did that because my brother Roger introduced boxing to me. And I went down to that gym in Palmer Park, Maryland, put the gloves on, and being the quiet kid, introverted kid, really, really afraid of his own shadow. I found boxing, and boxing found me. That was my safe haven. That was my home away from home.
How old were you?
I was 14 at the time.
Well, the reason I ask that is that boxing is one in which you have to be aggressive, but that wasn't the nature of your personality at that time, was it?
Well, you know what? When I put the gloves on, I felt like Superman. I felt like invincible. And although I was, you know, naturally first starting, I was anything but a model of Ali. I was so bad, but I was so determined, man. I was so determined. I was such a student of the sport. I listened to everyone who had more than a day of boxing experience. I listened to coaches. I watched films. I want to be the best.
When you think about your family, how would you describe your family? Because in the book, it sometimes comes off, and the only word I can think of is dysfunctional. Is that a fair word?
You know, you want to say dysfunctional. For me, in my neighborhood, it was normal. That's all I saw. I saw that fighting. I saw that violence on the streets. And I saw it in my home. That was normal to me. That's all I knew. But to see your parents go at each other, and it's always because of money. And it was also because of, you know, my dad's behavior. But life itself, I mean, my parents loved us. I mean, they worked hard. My dad worked at a supermarket. I mean, we rarely saw him. He worked so hard. And my mom was an LPN, a licensed practical nurse. She worked very hard. I mean, they made sure that we had food and shelter.
One of the things that I find interesting is the fact that when I've talked to black athletes, at some point in the conversation, Ray, they'll always bring up their mother. And the black woman in the family is always a very, very strong person. And yet, in your book, you talk about your mother's mood swings and how she could be violent. What do you think was the cause of that?
My mom was one of the best moms. She protected her kids. You know, if you did something to me and my mom heard about it or I told her about it, you better hide. She was not one to back down from anyone or anything. And, you know, my mom, the only time I remember my mom changing was when my father upset her. And she never drank in front of us, never, ever. But she would go into the room or to the bathroom, and she'd come out just another person. But I saw that a lot. I mean, that was like me, you know, because a lot of times I didn't want people to know what I was doing, whether it was drugs or alcohol, but I would go into a room and I would keep smiling, because if I smiled, I thought my ignorance, I thought that no one knew. I didn't let anyone on to know what I was doing. But that's that selfishness, and that's just that me syndrome.
Is the use of drugs and alcoholism, because I've never been involved with it, you understand it better than I do because you saw it in your family, you've experienced it, is it an escapism?
Without question, for the most part. For me, I can only speak for me. Listen, 1982, when I retired from boxing one of many times, I was wealthy, I was famous, I had it all, but I was 25. And my career has stopped. And I was in limbo. So all of a sudden, I had new friends. I had new people around me. They were doing it. And I saw that they were having fun. I started doing it. I started doing it more and more and more. And because I had the funds to buy it, I kept buying it. I bought a lot of it, almost too much. The alcohol escalated as I became less and less of a husband to my first wife, Juanita. I mean, she tried the best she could, and she did the best she could in raising my two kids, which she did an excellent job. But I was such a jerk. I saw her last week in Atlanta because I was at a book tour, book signing, and I took her to dinner, and I kind of apologized. I didn't say kind of. I did, without saying it. I just looked at her, and she looked back at me, and she smiled. And that told me that it was okay.
How angry do you get at yourself when you think back at some of the things that you did?
You know, if I can just just say I'm sorry, and that meant enough, I would do that. But it's not enough. Sometimes you create irreparable harm to someone, especially someone that you love. And I love my first wife, Juanita, without question. I mean, she tried her best. She tried the best of her ability to protect me from not just drugs and alcohol, but from people in general. And I never gave her, I never listened. It was all about me. Everything was about me. And so since I've been involved with the AA program, I've learned to be of service, to really be humble, to surrender. And that, too, has made an enormous difference, Ron, in my life. You know, it's all about giving back now.
Tell me a little bit about your development as a boxer when you were a kid, because you eventually ended up in the Olympics, of course. But when did you think you had something special in this sport?
The first day I put the gloves on, the first day I put those mitts on, I knew this was my sport. Because to me, baseball and football were too dangerous. I really, really...
Wait a minute.
You heard
too
me.
Dangerous?
They were dangerous. Yeah, I mean, they were dangerous. And I this because, Ron, boxing was what I could control eventually as I became a student of the sport. I listened to ex-champions and present champions, and anyone that was better than me, I listened to them. I've read, I looked at magazines, and I watched tapes, and I emulated Muhammad Ali. I emulated Sugar Ray Robinson. I carried myself like Bruce Lee. I mean, those people were so just powerful and confident, and I wanted to exude that kind of confidence. And boxing gave me that ability to control what stood in front of me.
Did it also give you stature as a young kid in the black community?
Oh, without question. No question about that. When my picture, or even my name first was on the local paper, I was the man. I was the man. And all of a sudden, these girls wouldn't give me the time of day. All of a sudden, I still like you. What? You know? It was so funny looking back on those moments, because I was such a wallflower. Plus, I had gap tooth. My hair was not the perfect afro. My shoes were too small because I wore my brother's shoes, alligators, by the way, and pants was too tight or torn. I mean, I was a mess. But boxing gave me confidence. Boxing gave me a sense of self. Boxing was my life.
You were named after Ray Charles, but who put the sugar in front of it?
I did. You know, I gave credit to Sergeant Johnson, who was the assistant boxing coach, a wonderful man, a man who just told us how great God is. He always prayed for the team. He always prayed. He was a special man. And when they asked me, they said, well, who called you Sugar? Then somehow someone said, Sergeant Johnson. It sounded sounded so great that I said, yeah, he called me Sugar. But I saw Sugar Ray Seals, and I watched Sugar Ray Robinson, and I recall there was a cape that I had designed for me that said Sugar Ray. And I was like, yeah, I'm Sugar Ray.
You talk in the book about the sexual victimization of black boys in the sport. That surprised me a little bit because I had not heard a lot about it. Tell me about it from your personal experience.
Well, again, I don't know where you found that, but no, I didn't know this was as prevalent as it is or has been with athletes in general. I don't know of any other boxer that has have experienced what I have. If there is, I will tell them to step forward, tell them to be open, and tell them to rid their bodies and minds and hearts of something that ate at me, that killed me every day until now, until I did this book. It took all those 30-some years to come to the realization, to understand, Ron, that I was dying inside. I mean, all the things I have, all the blessings I have with a wonderful wife and Bernadette, with my four kids, my two youngest kids, Daniel and Camille. I have that. My parents are still living. Both my parents are still living in spite of all the wars they had indoors. My dad just turned 89. God bless him. June 9th. My mom is still a feisty 82-year-old. You know, my brothers and sisters. I mean, I have such a great life, a wonderful life. I'm so blessed that I tell people, especially the guys who experience this, don't even say I'm a man and you may appear to be weak. Get it off your chest. Get it out of your head.
Let me take you to the Olympics, 1976, Montreal, Canada. Arguably the best and greatest Olympic boxing team we ever had. The experience for you when you look back upon it now as compared to when you were living it?
You know, I was so enamored. I was so into it that I didn't smell the roses during the Olympics. I mean, during the opening ceremonies, you know, we walking around, thousands of athletes, incredible, top of the line of their country athletes. You know, I was homesick. I wanted to go home. I wanted to fight. I mean, I wanted all these things. And then when I won my gold medal and it's over, I rushed to the camper that my parents had driven up to cheer me on, to be with me. I wanted to go home. Now I sit back with far more appreciation and just the sheer joy of being on the Olympic team. Ron, there's no, I tell you, man, it's no greater feeling than to say I was in the Olympics.
Even more so than winning a world championship?
They're two different things. They're two different things. Because the Olympics wasn't about money.
It wasn't business.
It wasn't business. It was about representing yourself and your country and being the best and bringing home the gold medal. That was ultimate. I turned pro. Not because I wanted to. Because I had to.
Your dad's illness?
My dad was sick. My dad was in a coma. I turned pro to pay the bills.
Let's move on from the Olympics and talk about your pro career a little bit. Two people that were significant in your career, and I want you to tell me about the first time you met Howard Cosell.
Special man. Incredible friend. Just a guy who was so different in front of a camera. He was Howard. You know, we've had great talks together. He didn't yell. He didn't tell me how great he was. He didn't tell me how he had a photographic memory. But he was a friend. He was just a friend. And I recall when one day, well, I had just announced that I wanted to fight Hagler. And I went away to West Hampton, I believe it was, or Southampton, whatever, whichever one it was, I don't recall. And I'm walking down the street with my wife, Juanita, and I hear this, "Sugar Ray, what are you doing in my neighborhood?" I turned around. It was Howard Cosell. And I went to his home for lunch. He said, "Son, you know what? You shouldn't be fighting. You're going to get hurt." I said, "Howard, I believe I can win this fight." "They told you don't write a book. You wrote that book because you believed in the book. I believe I can beat Hagler." He said, "I guess you're right." And that was the first time I ever knew Howard could just shut up, you know? But he was a dear friend. I mean, he did things that people didn't know anything about. Every summer, he would send inner-city kids to camp. I mean, he did things from the heart. What he did in front of the camera was a different story. But what he did outside that arena was so special.
I'm going to share you with you a Howard Cosell story that you're going to love. Working with Al Michaels, Monday Night Football. And they had finished the broadcast, and they're in the limo, and they're going back to the hotel. And they go by this corner. And there's some kids duking it out. And they go by it, and Howard says to the driver, "Stop this car." And he says, "Back it up." And he backs it up. And Howard gets out of the car, and Al grabs him and says, "Howard, look, let's not get out of this car here." He gets out of the car, and as soon as he gets out, the kids immediately stop fighting because they know who it is. And he goes up to one of the fighters and says, "You're the diminutive one. You have no punch at all. And you have no counter at all. So stop this stuff." And the kids are so stunned, and they get back. He gets back into the car, and Howard, you know, turns to Al Michaels, and Al says, "Howard, we could have really gotten hurt." And Howard, dead-faced, looked at Al and said, I know who I am.
That's Howard. That is so Howard. No one else could have done that.
Yeah. He was always there for you, was he not?
He was so supportive. I mean, he stressed his concern that I could seriously, in fact, that was a concern of most people, that I could get really hurt coming back after the surgery and after being away for so long. But I believed in myself. I truly believed. I mean, I always knew in the dressing room when I was going to win. I knew. And the times that I lost, the three times with Duran won, Terry Norris and Camacho, as I walked to the ring, I knew that night was not my night. You talking about frightening? You talking about scared? And I admit this. I mean, it was real. And all I said was, wow, man, I wish they would agree to me postponing this thing for a couple of days. Because the next day, I would be feeling better. But that particular night of those particular fights, I just didn't want it. I didn't want to fight.
Yeah, it's interesting because athletes can tell that. I mean, pitchers can be in the bullpen, and they know when they don't have their good stuff, they're not going to be able to go out that. I've even had quarterbacks tell me, I don't think this is going to be a good game. Again, I want to urge you to check this book out. It's called The Big Fight, My Life in and Out of the Ring. The author is Sugar Ray Leonard. We've talked about the Olympics. Now let's talk a little bit more about your pro career. The other person I wanted to ask you about is Angelo Dundee, because he was so significant in your life. How did you meet him? How did you two guys get together?
Well, I met Angelo Dundee many, many years ago when I was an amateur boxer. I had went up to Deer Valley, Muhammad Ali's training camp, and Angelo was so special. He was such an asset in my career because, you know, Ron, he said the right things at the right time without showing any signs of desperation. I could feel it. The urgency, but he never seemed to be losing it. He was such a pro.
Always in control?
Always in control. And we've had some special times together. Although he bumped heads, he and my attorney, Mike Trainor, bumped heads because Mike Trainor always felt that Angelo wasn't doing what he was paid to do, if you will.
How were you brought along as a pro?
You know, I fought once a month. I mean, I
remember those early fights. Yeah, you were out there all the time because ABC, you know, just fell in love with you.
Yeah, I mean, it was great. The fact that I was learning at a very fast rate. I was fighting fighters from all over the country and all over the world. And that gave me my versatility to fight guys when it was time, like Hearns, like Roberto Duran, like Marvin Hagler. Benitez. I mean, I was a rounded fighter.
Yeah. Also, you developed as a personality as well. Was that by design? I mean, as you said, the networks fell in love with you. I mean, it wasn't just another boxer in the ring. It was a guy that was a showman in the ring as well.
Well, it was real. I mean, I did smile. That was real smile. Never mind my real teeth. Well, some of them. But, that's me. I mean, that's just me. But I also understood that you have to be available for the media, for the fans. But that was the easy part because I enjoyed that. I fed off that. And a lot of the boxers, or some of the boxers, or some of the critics, I should say, felt that I was being like a television or network fighter. I heard that many times.
Yeah, they said you were a production fighter.
Yeah,
I heard that too. Let me ask you about, you fought with the likes of Marvin Hagler, Roberto Duran, Tommy Hearns, and Wilfred Benitez. I consider that to be the golden age of the middleweights of boxing because everybody always measures boxing by the heavyweights. But am I correct in assuming that that was the golden age for boxing for that weight area?
Yeah, I mean, from the welterweights, from the middleweights, I mean, but, you know, I tell you, all the non-heavyweights were great fighters. The thing about it, Ron, there was so much talent in each division, each weight division, that you had to be on your A game if you wanted to retain your title. I mean, there were guys out there so good and so determined to get a shot at the title. And it was tough, and it was extremely competitive.
Everybody remembers, of course, the Nomas fight. That's the one that gets a lot of talk. But I saw a quote in your book that kind of jumped out at me, and I want to ask you about it, because the quote came from Dr. Roger Leonard when he said, "Ray, you've got to embarrass Duran."
My brother, Roger. Oh, my gosh. Roger, my brother, who got me into boxing, was really a great athlete himself, but he was a part-time boxer because he did heroin on the side and smoked cigarettes, you know, alcohol, women. I mean, he wanted to be both playboy and fighter, but you don't play boxing. But he was the one, he was the guy who taught me or told me how to beat Duran in the second fight, in the rematch. He said, "Ray, you got to make him mad. You got to frustrate him, push his head down, do this, do that." So those antics that he displayed, the bolo punch and all those things, I looked at my brother like he was crazy. You can't do that to Duran. You can't do that to any fighter, because you drop your hands too low. And those were the antics that really was icing on the cake for, from my point of view, for Duran's frustration and throwing his hands up.
The thing that surprised you the most about that fight, it says in the book here, is that he quit, because boxers are warriors. Boxers don't quit.
Yeah, because fighters don't quit. But Duran was so, I think he was just so frustrated. It was like blowing a fuse. And I think he threw his hands up without truly realizing the repercussions it would have on his image, on his legacy. Duran, without question, is a legend. He's a great fighter. But that particular night got the best of him.
You also talk about your friendship with him to some degree, about how he helped you later on. You had two exchanges with him. One, he told you how to be able to beat Haglund.
Yeah, I was at that time, I was retired again. I was retired a lot of times. But I'm sitting at ringside with HBO, and I'm doing commentary. And he fought Haglund for 15 rounds. And after the fight, he leaned over between the ropes, Ryan. He said, "Ray," I mean, it was weird. I thought it was weird. He said, "You box him, you beat him." Those exact words, verbatim. And I looked, and I thought about it, but then after the third or fourth beer, I forgot about it.
And the second exchange happened just before the third fight.
Well,
he said, "Thank you."
Well, our third fight, which took place at Mirage in Las Vegas, and because Duran was really financially handicapped, it was so amazing that he came over to me and he hugged me at the press conference. He said, "Thank you so much." At first, I didn't know what to make of what he was trying to say, because I didn't put it together. But after walking away, I said to myself, he's thanking me for this fight because he needed the money.
I remember Muhammad Ali telling me one time, when I asked him about why boxers stay so long in the ring beyond their prime. And he said to me, he said, it's a little bit like a fire horse. When the bell goes off, they kind of respond to it. And if you remember the last part of Muhammad's career, it was embarrassing. It really, really was. And you said in the book about the detached retina was actually a blessing. What were you talking about?
Well, because, I mean, it kept me out of the ring for a period of time. I mean, those years of taking, absorbing punishment could have been a factor. This is hypothetical. I don't know for sure, but that's my take on things. But then again, you know, I could have been even a better fighter. Who knows? It's too big of a question mark to really elaborate on. But I kept in shape though, Ron. I really kept myself in pretty good shape. I was playing tennis every day, you know, long hours, 4 hours, 5 hours here, and my legs. I think if anything, it was my legs. Against those comebacks that allow me to steal the victory.
You really filled a void for boxing in the early 80s after Muhammad Ali decided to retire. Tell me about the first time you met him in 1976.
I met him at his training camp, and he was God to me. He was so bigger than life, bigger than boxing. And when he kind of grabbed me, and one day he said, "You know what? If you ever decide to turn pro, make sure you get my man." Speaking of Angelo Dundee, he said he has the right connection for the, he has the right complexion and the right connection. And he said, also make sure you take care of yourself and watch your money. He said, because you're taking those punches, you make sure you control that. And that was the most sound advice I've ever received, the best advice that I've ever received.
Sugar Ray Leonard, a champion in the ring and now happier out of it. Moving on to football, anyone who can play professional football nearly 20 years has my respect. It's a tough, physically demanding sport that takes its toll on every player's body and life. Quarterback Craig Morton played 18 years with the Cowboys, Giants, and Broncos. He's the first quarterback to start the Super Bowl for two different teams, Dallas in Super Bowl V and Denver in Super Bowl XII. He also preceded two future Hall of Famers, Roger Staubach with the Cowboys and John Elway with the Broncos. Morton played his college ball at Cal and is a member of the College Football Hall of Fame. I started talking to him by asking Morton, how hard is it to play pro football double-digit years?
Well, I guess the best explanation would be that I'd play a season, walk by a hospital, check in, have an operation, go through the rehab, and start all over again. That was kind of like what I did. And but that's just that's the game that you love, and people often ask me, you know, quite a bit, would you do it again? Certainly I'd do it again. The way my body feels now, depending on the weather, and now we're San Francisco weather, that arthritis just peps up and kind of says attention.
I want to ask you about that motivation, because I've never talked to an athlete who played in the National Football League who did not tell me it wasn't worth it. What is that rationale that'll let you put your body through that and have to deal with the pain each week?
Well, I think if I look back upon it, there's many times that you get up and you ask yourself, do I want to go back to the huddle? I mean, I'm hurting. I've, you know, there one season, the first play of the year, I separated my left shoulder, and I got rolled up out of bounds, and I'm walking back to the huddle, and I'm looking at the sideline. I said, boy, it'd just be so easy to go over that sideline, just take a little rest. Then I look at the huddle, and I see my guys, and I don't want to go to the sideline. I want to beat those guys. No matter how hurt I am, I can still play. You know, and I've been watching a lot of this stuff on TV about the Navy SEALs, and certainly it's a lot harder than anything we ever did in football. But it just reaffirms that if you can do so many things, if you're mentally tough enough, if you want to do it, you can pull yourself through so many things. And just like our great young men in our forces now, what they're going through and what they're pulling themselves through, we're just a little example of that. We love the game so much, get up, you can play.
When you take a look at the way the game is played today, you watch it on television, you go to a ball game, and you think about how the game was played rule-wise and the way the players could do what they wanted to do. Maybe they're not as big as they were or as fast as they are today. What changes do you see? And do you kind of smile a little bit because it was kind of free warfare out there on the field when you were playing?
Well, I think what Jack Lambert said, well, you can't give the quarterback skirts or whatever he's famous for saying. The game, I think, has changed. Not so many, so much defenses. I think they're all about the same. There's a little bit more zone defense than when I played. But the game's basically the same game played by bigger, faster, stronger, with lighter equipment and faster fields. So it makes for a lot of injuries, I guess a lot of excitement. I don't watch a lot of NFL football. It's changed so much to me as a player, and there's a lot of things that I'm the old type of guy that they just didn't take care of us, and they're not taking care of the older guys. And it just kind of sticks in me, not to complain. I mean, I feel for the guys that haven't been taken care of. And so the game seems to have left the other guys behind.
Yeah, I want to get into that a little bit later on, because that is an issue that needs to be addressed by the National Football League. But what about specialization today? I mean, when you guys played, you're out there if you're on defense for all four downs. You didn't have a nickel package, a dime package. You didn't have specialists who did this or that. How much has that changed the game, Craig?
Well, there were nickel packages and dime packages, but not as specialized as it is now, you're right. Guys get drafted first or second just by their ability to return punts, which is a great asset because they figured out that special teams are just as important and maybe sometimes more important than the other two phases of the game. So the special type, you know, they bring the pass rusher in or the third down or a second down run guy. So I guess it is specialized. I don't think the game's changed that much except for what I said. The the one thing is the equipment is so light on these big, strong people that work all year round. They're amazing athletes.
Let me ask you about the quarterback position, because it's one that's fascinating to me. I don't think that there is a position in football that is needs so much multitasking. I mean, you have to read defenses, you have to time management, you also have to be aware of what's happening, you have to change plays, all of that. Am I correct in assuming that that position takes more multitasking than any other position in football?
Probably so. Defensive guys like middle linebacker are about the same. I mean, they're constantly changing up plays and they're on their defenses. But, yeah, quarterback has the main responsibility to get everything done. He's got to call in the huddle, tell everybody what to do, and then when you're on the line of scrimmage, if the blocking thing that you called in the huddle is not right, you got to change the blocking. Make sure they know where the key people are. That's why you see a lot of quarterbacks point. We never did point per se, but you see a lot of pointing by quarterbacks. They're telling people where they are so they know where they're spacing, or if they're going to zone block, or they're going to wheel to the left or right. It's just part of the game that they're just saying, okay, here's where everybody is. Do your job.
I've always been interested in quarterbacks as far as how they shut out everything else around them and can laser focus on either a receiver or do their job. I mean, the normal human tendency, Craig, you know, is that you're looking around, you're aware of things, and if you're going to get hit by anything, and I'm talking about the average person, you know, you protect yourself and stuff. Quarterback can't do that. He has got to be lasered in on what he is trying to do.
And every quarterback has a moment where I remember mine to this day. I was playing with Dallas, and I looked down when I was setting up to throw the ball. And when I looked down, I heard the game. And I said to myself, and not the words I'm going to say now, but it was, you chicken, if you ever look down again, you can never play this game. Because you start hearing the game, and the game is scary. So the reason that you got to have great dedication to keep your concentration is so you don't hear the game and everything is just blanked out. You know, you never really hear the crowd except when you throw the ball and you're knocked down. And you if it's a cheer, you know that's a complete. If it's a boo or something, you know it's incomplete. But you don't hear the crowd. But it's also funny that you have so much confidence like I did on the football field. Now, if I'm going out and playing in a golf tournament, you talk about looking around and being nervous. I mean, it is entirely different. I said, wait a minute, I was in front of 80,000 people and it didn't bother me. Now I'm in for a couple hundred, and I can barely bring it back.
When you take a look at the teams that you played on, how important was it, the supporting cast, as far as the success for you or any quarterback on any team?
It's the team that makes it, and defense that wins championships. My years, I played 9.5 years with the Cowboys. A lot of Hall of Famers there. Had a lot of great players, and we had a lot of great championships. The Giants, when I went up there, we didn't have very good, nothing was really good up there except that I always wanted to play in New York. And then when I went to Denver, we really had just something was missing. We had a new coach, Red Miller, quarterback. I came in, and everybody believed. I remember going in the locker room the first day I was there, and Lyle Zeta was there, and he said, he looked at me, and he said, now we'll win a championship. And so a lot of great moments and a lot of great players, but it's all the teammates that make it possible. Because I played on teams where I've been sacked 8 or 9 times. Darren Talbert, I remember from Washington Redskins, had me about 8 times in a game. And I'd keep pointing to my left guard and just wave another one in. Get this guy out. Somebody's got to help me. And so it's all the people around you that make you what you are.
You know, I find it interesting. There's a great story about John Brody when he played with the 49ers and Jack Christensen, who was his coach then. And they did not get along very, very well. And matter of fact, the story goes that John would call the offense together on Saturday night and change the game plan over a poker game while they were over at the house. But the one story was the 49ers, when they were out of Kezar Stadium, they were trailing going into the second half. So as they came out of the tunnel, and Kezar was a place that, you know, yes, you did not want to be trailing because the fans.
I played there a few times.
Yeah.
Yes.
The fans would be throwing stuff. And Jack made sure he was out in front of Brody about 5 yards. And as they were coming out and the fans were booing, he turned around to Brody and said, hey, kid, they're really on you today. That relationship between the coach and the quarterback, how tenuous, how important is it?
Well, most of the coaches I had great relationships. Coach Landry was, as far as I'm concerned, probably knew more about football than anybody that ever lived. The one bad thing is a lot like my father, didn't communicate too well. So it brought out some of the worst in me, but it also brought out some of the best in me. But a great man, one I really, really respect. Red Miller was phenomenal. Then I played for Danny Reeves, who we were rookies together when we were with the Cowboys. So that was quite unique, and we got along well. So I got along with my coaches pretty well. I played for a guy, Bill Arnsberger, in New York. He was the New York Giants there. He used to be the great coordinator of the Miami Dolphins. He had a hard time in New York. The press up there is unlike, as you know. I mean, usually you get 5 or 6 people come out. They have 50 to 100. And they really got on him. They were really and they didn't like me too well either. But so we got real close.
We're talking football with Craig Morton, 18 years in the National Football League. Let's talk a little bit about your time down in Dallas. If I'm not mistaken, was it 1965 your first year?
Yes.
And so they had only been in professional football for 5 years at that time.
That's right.
What was the development of the franchise at that point when you joined them? What were their, you know, their trademarks?
Well, when I was drafted, I was drafted by the Cowboys in the first round, and then Al Davis wanted me. That's the years when the AFL and the NFL were kind of competing against each other, which was really an interesting story anyhow. You've probably heard those many times, but they hide you out. But I decided that I just didn't want to play in Frank Ewell Field here in Oakland, which was before the Coliseum. So I went to Dallas because I thought it was a great opportunity and good way to get away. And I received $150,000. My bonus was $150,000 plus salary for 3 years, which was good in those days. It's you know, not too much today, but part of the bonus was I got an XKE automobile. And my senior year at Cal, I'd keep walking down the street and see if that car was there, because I said, I'm getting that car. That was kind of my impetus to have a good season. So I got the car. After I got a Cal, drove it down to Dallas, got into Dallas, and it was about 97 degrees. I didn't have any air conditioning in the car, never drove it again. I traded in for something that had an air conditioner. Here, my whole life is just XKE, and it was a tin can down there. It was just so hot. But getting with the team, the first year we went 7-7, and then from then on we started winning championships. And, well, we had some good players, and Bob Lilly and of course, Don Meredith and Don Perkins. We had a whole array of just phenomenal players. And then Coach Landry, and he just kept going. And Coach Landry coached every position, although he had assistants, but he wouldn't ever let them have the final say-so. But we just got better and better and got to the Super Bowl in it'd be 1971 or 70, so it's my fifth year. Don Meredith retired when he was 30 years old. I thought he was, you know, 50. But he and Landry didn't get along very well, and I was up at the Russian River driving with some friends, and I heard on the radio that Don Meredith retired and I was going to be the quarterback. That was very, very surprising. And I had some good years, and then Roger Staubach came. We went back and forth. What a great player, and, you know, All-Pro and Hall of Fame. So whatever I did with my teams, you know, I think I made them better. They certainly made me better, and I had a great time.
When you talk about Tom Landry, I've heard a lot of people say that he was not a real warm, fuzzy type of guy, and communication was not a strong point. And we know about North Dallas 40, certainly right. The book and everything. How close to the fact was that book?
It's Pete Gent was my roommate when he was writing that, and I didn't know he was writing it. But it's pretty accurate. Most of it, you know, some characters, there's 3 or 4 characters in one character in the movie and in the book. To tell you about Coach Landry, that sometimes he did not want to face the decisions that he wanted to make or had to make. And a lot of times, in fact, there was three times that Roger and I, it was going to depend what kind of preseasons we had. In those days, you had 6 preseason games and it was just like the whole season. And then he said, well, whoever has the best preseason will start. So 1 year I'd get it. And then if I didn't get it, I'd get a phone call about 10:30 at night and he'd be on the other line. And he said, Craig, hi, Coach. And he says, you're home. I said, yes, I'm home. He thought I was always out. So
that's because his other players were right. Out.
They were out, too. So he said, can you drop by? Yeah, and I said, now? And he said, sure. So I went over to his house. Alicia, his wife, opened the door. coach is in his study, so I went in his study and sat down. He said, Craig, he says, got a feeling I'm going with Roger. Thanks for coming over. And that was it. So I said, that's it? He said, yeah, I just got this feeling.